And thanks for listening to us on the Jefferson Exchange today. We're always glad for your time and attention. And if you'd like to join us here on the Exchange in our conversations, feel free. Phone numbers are as follows. Anywhere in the listening area, 800-838-3760. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. For all the times we sing sleep in heavenly peace through the month of December, there's often a distinct unpeace when it comes to discussing the meaning of the Christmas season. Between the Fox News coverage of the so-called war on Christmas and declarations of Jesus is the reason for the season, it can get a bit heated at times. We'll go beyond the heat and the halo, in a sense, and talk about the life of the human being who became Jesus Christ to the world. Ashland Rabbi David Zaslow wrote a book with Joe Lieberman, delving into the life and religious surroundings of Jesus. It is called Jesus, First Century Rabbi. David Zaslow is our guest once again on the Jefferson Exchange. Welcome back.
Thanks, Jeff. Great to be here.
Really good to have you.
Thanks.
In your preface, you discuss the different views of Jesus, including the Jewish view of Jesus. I mean, how do Jews view him generally?
Well, generally speaking, historically, because of the development of anti-Semitism through the ages, Jews on a theological level tend to avoid dealing with Jesus, both theologically and as a historic figure. The 20th century changed all of that. With 20th century scholarship, and especially with Jewish studies departments, you had many religious Jewish people getting involved in studying the New Testament and studying Jesus as a historic figure. So really, for the first time in the last 20 years, my book is kind of riding a wave of really wonderful scholars whose shoulders that I stand upon, who are writing about Jesus as a historic figure for the first time with really good good archaeological and supportive literary evidence about who he was and what his life was like.
What was the step further that you wanted to take, though? I mean, how much further did you want to rise above the shoulders of those who preceded you?
Thank you. I think the step further that I'm trying to take is to lessen the surface tension in interfaith dialogue. The first level of interfaith dialogue is, of course, tolerance. Can we even tolerate each other existing on the planet at the same time? The second level is really understanding. And so in the 60s and 70s, when Protestants and Catholics and Jews would get together, and Muslims and Buddhists and Hindus, for that matter, or people of any faith, it was really tolerance and then to the level of understanding. I'll tell you what I believe, you tell me what you believe. And we share in that way. I wanted to push it a little bit further with this sense of celebration. The idea that just as in creation, you have ecodiversity. The healthiest ecosystem is a diverse system. I think the same thing, many of us, many theologians, I'm not the first to say this, of course, many theologians believe that spiritual diversity is really important, that there's a purpose, that Buddhism can do something that Hinduism can't. Hinduism can do something that Native American or indigenous traditions can't. Christianity, Judaism, Islam, each have a contribution to make. When we can start to not just tolerate it, not just understand it, but actually celebrate it, is where I wanted to go to.
Do you get any particular pushback? I mean, do you get the whole, like, hey, you're a Jew, how can you write about Jesus?
Yeah, I was hoping to get that pushback, actually.
Really?
Raza Aslan, the author of Jesus the Zealot, was on Fox Network, as you might have heard, and the interviewer said to him, how could a Muslim write about Jesus? And, of course, he pushed back on that, and he said, well, I'm a scholar. You know, I happen to be Muslim, but that's irrelevant. So, of course, his book rose immediately to the top-selling book on Amazon. So I wrote to, actually, Dr. Aslan and asked him who the interviewer, how do I make contact with him at Fox? Because I would really like to have somebody say, what's a Jew writing about Jesus for?
Rocket you to the top of the list right now.
Exactly, right. Maybe you'll do this for me today. We'll see.
We shall see.
I'll check on my Amazon rating.
We don't have the same kind of a heat and light ratio.
Well,
we'll
see.
Fox News
has. You're pretty good, Jeff.
Well, thank you. Is this true? What you wrote in the book about an evangelical pastor once said to you that either Jesus is the Savior or he is a fraud.
Yeah.
What did he mean?
Yeah, you know, he meant so well, and I just want to say this really clearly. This did not come out of any prejudice against Jews, per se, or me. He really believed that everything was black and white. Either he is the theologic Jesus, the Son of God, he was a Trinitarian, a God incarnate, or he was a fraud. He was giving me a black and white question, one or the other. And in Judaism and many other spiritual traditions, it's not necessary to go black or white. If I'm right, you must be wrong. And if I'm going to heaven, you must be going to hell. And this was the difficulty, is that he really believed so strongly, as many evangelical Christians do, really well-meaningly, in the theologic Jesus alone, and that without Jesus, there's no chance of eternal life or salvation. And so this is the challenge that that many of us face in dealing with ideological positions in all religions.
And we had another guest not long ago who talked about the binary thinking in the Christian faith that permeates American culture, was the case he was making, that is, you know, it started as a Christian thing, but it became like this is the way many of us think because we marinate in this culture all the time. And I know there's a reference in this book to dualism, yeah. But the whole black or white, this or that, right. Not a lot of shade of gray thinking there.
Yeah, I think, you know, binary thinking, it didn't begin in the Christian tradition. It really began, you can go back to Greek thinking, Hellenism, the genius of Plato and Aristotle. You could see it even before that in Mesopotamia. It is the only way to analyze the world. But the way to experience the world is through intuition, is through the other hemisphere of the brain. So they're both really, really necessary. But certainly the Hebraic or the biblical way of thinking, when you're studying the Bible in Hebrew, it's a lot more ambiguous than when you translate it into English. And this is part of the problem in interfaith dialogue, is that my Christian friends are studying the Bible in English, which is a translation and sometimes a translation of a translation. When you go back to the Hebrew words, the words like Messiah, the words like salvation and sin mean something completely different.
All right. I noticed you're very good about pointing that stuff out, too. You're a big fan of language and its meanings and its subtleties. We'll talk much more with David Zaslow, Rabbi David Zaslow, about his book with Joe Lieberman, Jesus, First Century Rabbi. And you can join the discussion on the Jefferson Exchange. Back with David Zaslow and your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today, Ashland Rabbi David Zaslow, he and Joe Lieberman of the Eugene area wrote a book called Jesus, First Century Rabbi, that seeks to pierce through the religious aspects of Jesus Christ and think more about the kind of person he was and the kind of religious tradition that he came from way back when. You can join this discussion on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. And Rabbi, you mentioned the people who have written material about the historic Jesus before you, quite a few of late, trying to go a step further to talk about the religious traditions from which Jesus arose. Given the work of the other people, though, have we gotten to a point, do you think, where we can discuss this calmly without people getting upset?
I think it's happening already. At the cutting edges, the leading edges, you might say, in religious traditions, the world is too small. You know, with the internet, with technology, with transportation the way it is, we can't hide anymore from each other. Our prejudices are just too obvious once it gets in the media, once someone posts it on Facebook or on social media. And so theologians always a little bit slow to respond because we're holding on to ancient traditions and we're doing the best we can and we all mean well, but we're holding on to a giant elephant. It's hard to turn it. But nowadays, it's just impossible to hide these prejudices, and so we're dealing with each other for the first time. And this includes the evangelical Christians, mainstream Christians, religious Orthodox Jews, mainstream Jews. Today, the dialogue is happening at an extraordinary rate.
We were talking just a bit before about language and certainly the things that change over time, particularly when people who study the Bible in English are probably reading a translation of a translation. From Hebrew to something else and from that language into English or maybe another. It seems to me there are probably several layers of language and translation along the way. But starting with some of the basics here, we're talking about a person whose name was Joshua?
Yeah, Yehoshua, right.
Mm-hmm. Not Jesus.
And his mother's name was Miriam in Hebrew. His brother James would have been Jacob or Yaakov. Luke would have been Levi. So we know what there was an attempt from the second century on really to de-Judaize Jesus, to take away his, they called him a Palestinian, which the Romans, they were afraid to say the Jewish land, Judea, so they would not use the term Judea, they used the word Palestine. So anything to de-Judaize him. And in the early church fathers, they even made him a northerner. So instead of letting him be a Mediterranean man with dark skin and curly hair, you know, they made him a little bit taller and longer hair and blue eyes and sometimes even blonde hair. And so they tried to do everything they could to de-Judaize him. Because he was a religious Jew. He lived as a religious Jew and he died as a religious Jew.
Which is the major question here, then. In his lifetime, Jesus never did stop being a Jew. He didn't say, I'm no longer Jewish. No, this is my church.
No, absolutely. In fact, the reforms he was trying to make as a reformist, so to speak, he was doing it as part of a tradition. So my book really goes through the proofs of the other rabbis like Hillel who came before him and Shammai who came before him that were already making the kinds of reforms that he was trying to maintain. What he did is he, you know, this is not a criticism or insulting in any way whatsoever, but Jesus didn't say anything original. But everything he said in an original manner. He was an extraordinary teacher, an extraordinary preacher, an extraordinary liturgist. But when you read the Our Father prayer or when you read the Beatitudes, every one of those phrases would have been familiar to his listeners. And his listeners weren't Lutherans or Presbyterians. They were Jewish.
So you're saying his strength was in synthesis, in translation, in interpretation.
Beautiful. That's exactly it. I should have had you write the foreword to the book. His strength was really seriously in synthesis. It's a beautiful way to put it.
Being able to put different ideas together or to find the absolute truth in the things that he was working
with.
But
they weren't foreign ideas. He wasn't trying to overthrow the temple system or Judaism. He was trying to reform it. But again, I want to say, he was part of a lineage of a tradition. He had teachers and he had peers, and he was right in line with those teachers and peers. And many of my Christian friends do not even know any of his contemporaries. Like, he was the only one preaching this Reformationist approach to Judaism.
So when you say it this way, Rabbi, the impression I'm left with is like when the difference between a so-so teacher and a really good teacher, you know, the one who all you hear is blah, 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 you know, algebra this, you know, 2xy equals z.
Exactly.
All that sort of thing. And the one who says, okay, if you do it like this, it works like this, and bing, the light goes on. So was this the strength of Jesus, you think?
Absolutely. Look, that's what the word anointing means in Hebrew. The word Christ in Greek, Christos, Messiah, Mashiach in Hebrew, really means one who is anointed. Now, in the Bible, there are seven men who are named Mashiach, who are named Messiahs. Like David was called Messiah. He would have really been, in the Greek, if you read a Greek Bible, he's called like David Christ. Cyrus, who wasn't even Jewish from Persia, was called Cyrus Christ. Now, when you read the translation, it will not put Christos, Christ in the English. It'll say the anointed one, because again, that's the spin that King James and the other Bible translators are trying to give you, that Jesus was somehow the only Christos, the only Christ. And I want to really make clear that I don't think there's a competition between the theologic Jesus and the historic Jesus. In other words, one thing my book tries to do is respect the theological Jesus, the Jesus that people believe in as the incarnation of God, as one of the Trinity. That's Christian theology, and it's gorgeous. It's beautiful.
And people can have both, you're saying?
I think you can absolutely have both. In other words, for me, I don't have both. As a practicing Jew, I can reclaim the historic Jesus as a native son of Judea. And that's where my book tries to push the edge too, is to ask my Jewish brothers and sisters, can we reclaim him at least as a native son who taught within Judaism?
So within Judaism, is there a sense of indignation or annoyance or, gee, he didn't follow the path or something with Jesus about him turning away?
Yes. Sadly, when you read the writings of the church fathers, geniuses in all other aspects, Justin Martyr, Chrysostom, John Chrysostom, these are great church leaders and great theologians, but they were very anti-Jewish. They were very, very anti-Judaism. And they would say things about what Jesus did in opposition to Judaism. The Jews bought into that. In other words, the Jews believed what the early church fathers were saying about Jesus' attitude towards his Judaism. So they weren't even looking at the historic Jesus. They were looking at the Jesus that was created by the church fathers.
So there's essentially no Jewish story of Jesus, or not a particularly well-fleshed out one?
No.
And I don't mean a pun with fleshed out, but
no,
in a sense, that's what we're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. No, there's no Jesus story in Judaism. Like I said, because of anti-Semitism, Jewish people tend to confuse or conflate Christianity with anti-Semitism. And we just basically try to avoid it as much as possible. The gospel has not been good news to the Jewish people, plain and simple. And so when the gospel has been preached to us, Constantine had a vision of the cross turning into a sword. The Crusades were aimed at converting Muslims and Jews to Christianity. So the good news has been really terrible news.
Rabbi David Zaslow, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book, co-written with Joseph Lieberman, is Jesus, First Century Rabbi. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Much to talk about here. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. And our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's start with Joe in Dillard. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Rabbi David Zaslow.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Just for the first time, watching Mel Gibson's movie, The Passion of the Christ, and I was interested in the rabbi's take on the language that was used in there. It had subtitles, if those people who watched the movie remember. And I understand that the language that was supposed to be spoken by Jesus in that movie was Aramaic.
Yes.
And I would like to know if that if that was just a real language, or if there was much scholarship behind the language issues in that movie, if the rabbi has any criticism of that. Also, I think that this whole issue can come back to an issue of capital punishment. I'd like to know if the rabbi has any information. Is there an official, does Judaism have an official position on capital punishment?
Okay.
Those are my two questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe.
Thanks, Joe. Very good questions. Yes, the language spoken in the street on a daily basis, if Jeff Riley were interviewing people in the first century, he would have been doing it in Aramaic, is the language. And so Jesus clearly would have been speaking Aramaic. And that was probably, for me, for the Jewish people, the only redeeming feature of that particular film. Mel Gibson's Passion was another passion play, very anti-Semitic at its root and very anti-Jewish at its root, very, very harsh. It was very painful, very, very painful to watch that play because, once again, it looked like the Jews were against Jesus. So it took the Christian scriptures, the New Testament, distorted it out of proportion. His followers were Jewish, and so the triumphal entry, for example, coming into Jerusalem, they were not Lutherans, they were not Catholics, they were Jews who were his followers. The reason they had a trial at night was possibly, this is called inferential thinking, we can't be sure of this, but the reason they might have had a trial at night is because we don't have trials at night, but they were afraid of a popular uprising by the Jewish people against taking one of their teachers away. And so anyway, Joe, good question. The movie itself I'm very critical of, and the language was very beautiful to hear a movie in Aramaic. Now, regarding capital punishment, it's probably too big an issue for me to tackle here. There's many, many, many views on that. But the general interpretation is always to avoid capital punishment wherever possible. It's not illegal in Jewish law. It's absolutely legal in Jewish law, but it's absolutely avoided whenever possible to try to redeem the individual.
Joe, thanks for those questions. Let's go to Monty in Roseburg. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Rabbi David Zaslow.
Yes, hello. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, good. I appreciate, Jeff, having the rabbi there. And this is a question that has bothered me for a long time. There's a book that came out in, I think it's 2007. In the book, the name of the book is The Jesus Family Tomb, and it's written by, I don't pronounce the name, Simcha Jacobovici and Charles Pellegrino. And it's about, they claim that there's an ossuary with the bones, at least with the remains of Jesus. And in that book, they claim that Mary Magdalene and Jesus had a baby. Now, you know, this is kind of, to me, this sounds like a fantasy, but I was wondering what you thought of it.
Thank you. That's really a very good question. I kind of avoid that literature. It's, because I just don't know enough about the Gospel of Thomas and some of the Gnostic Gospels that make all sorts of claims. I pretty much play it straight with the scholars and with the New Testament writings. We clearly know that his name, Joshua, was probably the second or third most common name in Jerusalem, that if I were to yell out in the street, you know, Yehoshua or Jesus in the streets of Jerusalem, every third guy would turn around. So the idea of the possibility of having a Joshua son of Joseph or son of Miriam would have been a very, very common name. So, you know, there's no proof that I know this, there's no proof that we have the ossuary or the bones of Jesus. That's pretty much for sure. I play it pretty straight with the scholars. I'm not a scholar. I'm a teacher. I'm a theologian. And so the scholars that I work with, and I recommend all our listeners tune into a book called The Misunderstood Jew by Amy Jill Levine. The Misunderstood Jew. It's an extraordinary book. She's a religious Jewish woman who teaches at Vanderbilt University. And it's an extraordinary narrative book about the historic Jesus. In fact, she was the co-editor of the first time Jewish scholars, Jewish, serious Jewish scholars, got a hold of, took the New Testament, and they wrote the Jewish Annotated New Testament, Oxford University Press. It's a must in any library for study.
And again, you know, a lot of the questions are dealing with crucifixion, resurrection, but essentially what you're talking about is the Jesus who lived and what went on in his life. And the title itself is somewhat provocative. Was Jesus ever a rabbi in a real technical sense?
That's a great question. Not in a technical sense. The term rabbi would have been, it was a term of kind of an endearing term for my teacher. That's the best translation. There was no ordination process until after 70 AD, after the destruction of the temple, you know, somewhere in the second century, when the ordination process started being developed. So he wasn't a rabbi in the technical sense of being ordained. He was a rabbi in the sense of being called a teacher.
I'm glad you brought up destruction of the temple. It leads right into the next question anyway, which is that you blow our minds right at the start of chapter one, that basically the birth of Christianity and the birth of Judaism as we know it now is essentially just decades apart in the same place.
It's extraordinary. It was sort of a kind of revelation to me, too, is that the birth of modern Judaism, I want to be clear that by the time Jesus was alive, Judaism was already a 2,000-year-old religion. It was already an ancient religion. But it was dependent upon a certain system of offerings at a specific place in Jerusalem called the Holy Solomon's Temple. So the fear was, in fact, the Hanukkah story is all about that. If you destroy or defile the temple, can the Jewish people survive if we don't have our place? And the answer from the Hanukkah story on, about 150 years before Jesus, right through the destruction of the temple at 70 AD, is yes, we can, but we have to change the structure from an offering-based system in the temple to the offerings were our prayers and charity. So here it is. Jesus is crucified. We don't really know the exact year, but let's just say around 36 of the Common Era, and the temple is destroyed 70. There, Jesus is crucified hundreds of yards, just outside the walls of the temple. And these two great religions are born just decades apart, coming out of a catastrophic event.
And certainly there were people who were alive at the time of the destruction of the temple who would have remembered, granted not many,
absolutely,
given the life expectancy at the time, but some who would have remembered
absolutely,
Jesus,
but not just Jesus. I want to make it very clear, not to take away anything special about him, but he was one of, according to Josephus, 50 to 100,000 Jews were crucified in the 100-year Jewish wars. The streets of Jerusalem on any given day were lined with crucifixes, Jews being killed because they were threatening the Roman Empire.
Let us take another call. We have Inward in Ash Valley on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Rabbi David Zaslow. His book is Jesus, First Century Rabbi.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I just had kind of a contemporary comment and a historical question. Contemporarily speaking, I think anti-Semitism is more applicable to Arabs than Jews. My question is about Zionism and the origins of it and how it relates to the God of Israel and Rabbi, sir, are you a Zionist, and what does that mean?
You know, in all respect to your question, I just don't think I'm going to go down that road with you, because it's kind of a loaded question the way you were asking it. The ancient nation of Israel used to be called Judea. It was the ancient homeland of the Jewish people. Many people from many ethnic backgrounds lived in that land at that time as they do today. Zionism, to really make it simple, is just the right of the Jewish people, but also affirming the right of any people to live in their ancient homeland, and today that ancient homeland is Israel, which hosts Muslims and Christians and Druze and atheists all living in that wonderful country.
He does remind us, though, that Semitic or Semite refers to more than just Jews, right?
In its literal etymological sense, absolutely. But the term has come to mean
anti-Semitic in the current
anti-Semitism,
context.
Right. Comes to mean being anti-Jewish.
All right. So, David Zaslow, you and Joe Lieberman write in the book about, and this is not Senator Joe Lieberman, by the way, it's the writer Joe Lieberman. I want to be clear on that.
Right.
You write about the leaders of Judaism in the modern sense, in the days after the destruction of the temple, responding to Christianity as it arose. How?
What do you mean?
Well, in other words, there were changes made to Judaism to correspond with what Christianity was doing as
okay.
it rose.
Okay. Just like in any good sport, I hate to make it like that that analogy, but good teams really strengthen each other. Look, I come from Brooklyn, so I'm a Brooklyn Dodger fan. So we hated the Yankees, but the Yankees helped make us a great team. And I think the New York Giants and the Brooklyn Dodgers made the Yankees a great team. And in Judaism has gained an awful lot from Christianity. The competition of the church are giving us notions. You see, for example, in language, the word salvation in Hebrew really means rescue from physical harm. So when in the triumphal entry, when people were chanting, save us, they didn't mean get us to heaven, Jesus. They meant get the yoke of the Roman Empire off our backs. So that's what they meant. So salvation had a very specific meaning. And that changed by the 3rd or 4th century. Judaism was beginning to come up with a sophisticated sense of the afterlife.
Saving versus salvation.
Okay. Exactly.
Lots of other ambiguities in language to cover here. We'll talk much more with David Zaslow about his book, Jesus, First Century Rabbi, and take more of your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about Jesus, the historical Jesus versus the religious figure, if you can separate those. Ashland Rabbi David Zaslow with co-author Joseph Lieberman has attempted to do just that. The book is called Jesus, First Century Rabbi. You can join our discussion on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760. Anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782 by email jx@jeffnet.org. I want to come back to the portion of the book where you show the leaders of the Jewish religion making changes to respond to Christianity and its explosive growth when it was first out there and growing explosively. But I want to understand in practice and in emphasis and scripture use, any of that stuff, I mean, how different is Judaism now from what it was like 2,000 years ago?
Great question. Starting in the Hasmonean period, the Hanukkah story period, Jews started actually creating an alternative to the temple system in Jerusalem. And they started doing that with, today we call it congregational worship, with fixed liturgy, with specific prayers that are chanted three times a day. This is what we do on Sabbath. This is what we do in the weekday mornings, bedtime prayers, the whole thing. That didn't exist in the formal sense before the first or second century, before the Common Era. So Judaism was already in the developmental stage, and you see Jesus as part of that development of what we call Mishnaic Judaism. This Mishnah was the oral teachings that was starting to be written down, development of a new Judaism. So that started happening. But nevertheless, Judaism was emphasizing sanctification of this world, doing good deeds in this world. Christianity comes along and starting to emphasize a spiritual sense of sanctification of the next world, of the world to come. Judaism did not have a specifically sophisticated view. It had a view, of course, of the other world, but not to the degree that Christianity was developing it. So they were mutually developing or inspiring one another or challenging each other in terms of these views. Christianity is not antinomian. It's not anti-law. It has a very good legal, has a very good basis of trying to make the world a better place. And Judaism is a very sophisticated view of the other world, of the afterlife. And that partially came in inspiration and competition one to the other.
You do show several tables of scripture showing Jewish root and Christian branch. It is funny, too. You refer to it as the Younger Testament, not the New Testament.
My teacher, Rabbi Zalman Schachter Shalomi, instead of saying Old Testament and New Testament, because who wants something old if you can have something new? So an Old Testament tends to be pejorative. He developed the term Elder Testament and Younger Testament. So first of all, it makes people laugh, just like you did. And I think it's time we started laughing a little more.
But again, I mean, the root and branch, I mean, and you mentioned before, like in things like the Lord's Prayer, you can definitely show where Jesus was not really wandering far from original doctrine at all.
Absolutely. When he came up with the golden rule, he was really quoting his teacher, Hillel. When he came up with the concepts of what adultery is, and be careful of even what you're thinking in your mind, that you need to control thoughts, that this also had to do with the rabbinic period. He was quoting rabbis, or he was at least in harmony with the rabbis of his day and age.
Well, I want to jump the line on the calls here because Joe Lieberman himself is calling in, your co-author.
Oh, wonderful. Hi, Joe.
Hey, hi, Rabbi David. I just wanted to say how thrilled I was to be able to participate in this project. Some people question, well, you know, I had written books about school shootings, which we've talked about on the air before. What's the connection? And the connection is that when I wrote about school shootings, the purpose was to make the world a better place by reducing school violence. And in this case, what I was trying to do with Rabbi Zaslow, what he had made a very, very good job of doing, is making the world a better place by creating a dialogue between Christians and Jews, which had been missing before.
Thank you, Joe. I didn't know that was the reason, one of the reasons why you personally wanted to join with me in the book. I thought it was because your name was Joseph Lieberman and people would confuse you with the senator and I'd get much higher book sales.
And they do all the time.
But
actually,
can't hurt you.
I was so impressed with your scholarship and your knowledge in these areas. And it was just the right book at the right time. This was something that literally the world needs at this moment.
Thanks, Joe. It was an honor, continuing to work with you.
And thanks for bringing it to our attention as well, Joe. Good job.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for calling. Let's go to Alicia in Klamath Falls. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Rabbi David Zaslow.
Oh, yes. Hi, Rabbi David. It's Alicia.
Hi, Alicia.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
This is my favorite subject, probably. I have a question about, I haven't read your book yet, about your discussion of the miracles and the whole notion of miracles in Christianity and the roots of that
beautiful.
In Judaism.
Beautiful. Thanks, Alicia. First of all, you can get the book at your local bookstore or at Amazon or Barnes & Noble or anywhere online now. You know, the miracles that Jesus was a miracle worker, as we know, and he was in the lineage of Elisha and Elijah. And again, this doesn't take away anything from Jesus. I want to be very clear to our Christian listeners. It's not critical. It's contextual. That Jesus didn't do any miracles that were original. All the miracles that he did were, you could see those same miracles of resurrecting people who've died and feeding the hungry and multiplication of food in the miracles of Elijah and Elisha. Walking on water, that was pretty
that was out there.
That was pretty.
That
unique.
Was a new one. Okay.
So you can go back to the Torah and find Moses splitting the water. So there were water miracles in the Old Testament and in the Younger Testament as well.
Oops, you said old.
Yeah, I did. I did say old.
Ah, gotcha. Tim and Eureka sent in an email that I want to bring in here. I agree with your speaker's premise that the overlap among religions is the wonderful elephant in the room, and we should all revel in the diversity of the divine. But the message of Jesus is simple enough to survive translation: love God, love others, and forgive.
Absolutely. Look, that's why my book is very clear. It's not only respectful. You know, I can't do this in a one-hour radio interview, but I celebrate the Christian message and the Christian gospel. It's simple. It's clear. It reaches out to the world. Look, there's a reason there's only 14 million Jews, and there's a reason there's 2 billion Christians. Somehow the message gets out there. It's much simpler. Judaism is a complex religion. Requiring a Jewish person to really do his work, her work, to sanctify the world we live in. Christianity's approach is from the inside out, from the heart right up to the soul. So it's a beautiful religion, and it's gorgeous. And I want to say it's rooted in Judaism. Jesus was a religious Jew.
Is the complexity, do you think, part of what leads to the rigorousness of Jewish thought, the rigorousness of Jewish scholarship? For example, getting into things like pointing out that atonement means something different.
Absolutely. I think so. Judaism is an intellectual religion. It's rooted in the mind, and then the mind reaches the heart and reaches up into the soul. And so the rigors of study require us, we're constantly, the name Israel means God wrestler. So mm-hmm. we're always wrestling. You know, there's a joke that says, if you have two Jews, you have four opinions. Which, Jeff, and that means if you have one Jew, you have two opinions. I mean, I'll say something and then I'll disagree with myself. That's part of the rigor of intellectual study in Judaism.
Well, let's talk about some of those terms, though, because atonement is a different sort of thing, depending
right.
on which language you take it from. Repent is another
yes.
one that you bring up.
Yeah, all of these words have ancient languages have multiple meanings. Judaism, Judea, the nation of Judea, is actually an Asian country. It's the most furthest west nation in Asia, but it's more of an Eastern religion, where Christianity took its roots in Greece and in Hellenism. So it's a dialogical versus dialectical way of thinking. So a word, let's say like breath, ruach, it means breath, which is physical. It means wind, which is nature. It means spirit, which is ethereal. So the one word has triple meanings. the word sin, one of the words for sin is chet, which means to miss the mark. It sounds much lighter in Hebrew. Chet means if you miss the mark, you try again. Sin really has a much heavier connotation. So all of these words, the Messiah means an anointed one, right? It doesn't mean the Christ, meaning the incarnation of God. It just simply means the anointed one. So language is very, very important. So when you're studying the Bible, the Elder Testament or the Younger Testament, find out what those words meant to those people who were saying it at that time.
That is an important step to take. Let's talk to Brad in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Rabbi David Zaslow.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I'm glad you have David on. It's been wonderful for me to watch him develop as a rabbi here in town.
Thanks, Brad.
Somebody called in and mentioned the Passion of Christ, and I would like to toot my own horn here for a second. I wrote a review that compared that movie to The Fog of War about McNamara remembering Vietnam, and I put it on my website, which is earthlyreligion.com, net or org. And I'd like David to take a look at it, because I make the point in there, among other things, that it's silly for Christians to blame Jews for killing Jesus, when in fact the Romans did. And it would be just as silly to say we should be mad at Italians today because of what Rome did then. It's just a
absolutely
silly
sure.
argument that goes on and on.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad he's put out this interesting book. I look forward to reading it. I'd like to discuss crucial words with him sometime.
Thank you, Brad.
Not at this phone call. Thanks.
Great. Brad, I wrote down the website, and I'm going to check out your article. I really appreciate you doing that. Thank you.
Earthlyreligion.com. Took a look at it just now. Thanks for that, Brad. Jesus is a microcosm of the nation of Israel, you write in Jesus First Century Rabbi.
Yeah. In Judaism, we take a look at the suffering of innocent people as representing the suffering of all the people. So when an innocent child dies, Jewish, not Jewish, it doesn't really matter. When an innocent individual dies or suffers at the hand of tyrants, they evoke in the nation, in the tribe, in the whole world, a sense of remorse, of regret. Today we commemorate the loss of Nelson Mandela. You know, most of us never met him, and yet somehow he touched our hearts and touched our souls, and that his death becomes a redemptive death. When somebody who is innocent suffers, whether it's Mandela going to prison or even his death, there's redemption in that death. In other words, it awakens. When I watch the news and read the reports of his life, I want to be a better person. You see, that's redemptive process of death. So as Israel suffered, the rest of the world had an awakening to become better people. And that's the influence of Judaism on the rest of the world. When Jesus died and suffered on the cross, the story wasn't just as Friday, the crucifixion. The story in Christianity is really the resurrection on Sunday. And the message of the resurrection is that there's life after death. There's hope after hopelessness.
There's a really interesting interpretation in the book, though, of that process, both for Judaism and for Jesus himself. And it's the concept of failure leading to success.
Right.
The quote is, on the surface, it can seem like the Jewish people failed in their mission to redeem the world. Jesus can be seen as having failed.
Absolutely. It's amazing that the destruction of the temple, which was a failure, so to speak, Moses not coming into the promised land, which was a failure, so to speak, the promise made to Abraham that he would be the father of multitudes, he died, so to speak, as a failure. He never saw that. King David wasn't able to build the temple in Jerusalem. He could be seen as having failed. That out of this failure, stories of redemption and hope come. So the story of Jesus, again, it's not the crucifixion, it's the resurrection in Christian theology. It's a story of hope coming out of hopelessness. It's a story of success coming out of failure. That's the extraordinary story. That's the gospel of Christianity, is that hope can come out of when you're most hopeless, that life can come after you've been killed.
Let's take another call. Here's Daryl in Mount Shasta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Rabbi David Zaslow.
Well, good morning. This is marvelous. My call is in regard to the rabbi's thoughts on the Gospels and the difference between the four classic evangelists, Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John.
Thank you. Great question. I go over it in my book, Jesus First Century Rabbi. Amy Jill Levine goes over it in great detail in the annotated Jewish New Testament. The four Gospels, at least the first three, the Synoptic Gospels, were probably written in Aramaic or Hebrew. We're not really certain. They're only available now in Greek. We don't have the originals. But clearly there are differences between them, the earlier Gospels, until you get to John, which really has a lot of anti-Semitic polemic in it, or at least the interpretation has been used against the Jewish people. So it's very challenging. It's impossible to do just standing on one foot on the radio here, but you have to study these Gospels in context to the entire Christian scriptures, but you must study the Christian scriptures in context to Elder Testament Judaism. That's the key that I'm trying to emphasize in the book.
How far in the book do you go in the story of Jesus' life? Because you were just talking about the death on Friday, but the resurrection on Sunday. Do you essentially stop your story at the death on Friday?
No, absolutely not. What I'm trying to say is that in Judaism, we have something called, we really call it the Pentecost. We call it Shavuot, that 50 days after we received the Torah at Mount Sinai, 50 days after we left Egypt, we received the Torah at Mount Sinai. There was this liberation, and then there was this revelation. So comparably, in Christianity, you have this idea of the crucifixion. It seems hopeless, and then you have the awakening, and then you have a Pentecost 50 days after that. Christianity is built upon the solid foundation of Judaism, and all Christian concepts, vicarious atonement, mediation, can be found rooted in ancient Judaism.
Carmelo in Bella Vista wants to ask about the influence of Rome on the formation of Christianity, with the theory that the Gospels might have been written later completely supported by Rome. He says some, such as Joseph Atwill, suggest that Jesus' character in the Gospels was created by the Romans to displace the Jews' promised vanquishing Messiah.
I think part of that is rooted in truth. I don't think Jesus in any way whatsoever, I'm just me, the scholars believe in the historic Jesus. There was no question he wasn't an invention. Clearly, when you're studying later parts of the Christian scriptures, you could say this was added on. It was added on. There were, you know, in the first century, that when it was redacted and first published, first put out, it was, you know, many, many, many decades after Jesus had lived and died. So clearly we have to read it in full context. When you're reading, for example, just really quickly, when you see the word Roman, it's used very neutrally because they were writing it knowing that the Romans were looking over them. When you read the word Jews in the New Testament, it's usually with a negative connotation.
Oh, they were vanquished already. The Romans were there basically acting as editors.
Absolutely. They were watching over them.
A provocative book.
Thank you.
Discussion, as always. Rabbi David Zaslow in Ashland, and his book is Jesus, First Century Rabbi. Thanks so much for joining
us. Thanks, Jeff. I really appreciate it.
Monday on the Jefferson Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk about the Klamath Basin water settlements. We'll talk about a lawsuit against the operation of the McKenzie River Fish Hatchery. And then we'll talk to the author of Far From the Tree, a book about how children who are born differently change us all. That's all Monday on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer, Charlotte Dern, our student assistant, Reed Newland. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.